Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
Hooray!
Hooray!
Hooray! I'm genuinely excited this week.
And I'm Richard Nicholas. Hello. The person who just spoke was Abby.
Hi.
And the person about to speak is Jamie.
Hello.
And then the next person to speak is Anthony.
How do you do?
And that makes up our spoiler-filled crew. And we're here, as we often are, to talk about a film and indulge ourselves and put it up as a podcast. So, you know, other people, hopefully people who've seen the film, can come along and have their opinions reiterated by a group of weird Welsh people. Yeah, so that explains that. This week's film, I'm carrying on. This week's film is Strange Days, and it was picked by Jamie, and he will now give some details as to what exactly Strange Days is and who made it.
Okay. Strange Days is a, I would say, dystopian sci-fi from 1995. It was directed by Catherine Bigelow, who went on to direct The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. And previously she directed Point Break and Near Dark, so she's got a pretty decent resume. Written by James Cameron. And it stars... I don't want to say Rafe, I want to say Ralph. His name's Ralph Fiennes. Angela Bassett, Juliette Lewis, Tom Sizemore, Michael Wincott, Vincent D'Onofrio. it's got quite a cast of... Oh, it's that guy. Like, lots of people in this film, apart from Rafe, who you don't know their names, but you instantly recognise their faces when they turn up. Yeah. And the plot, the basic plot outline from IMDb, a former cop turned street hustler accidentally uncovers a police conspiracy in 1999 Los Angeles. It's gotten to a point where technology allows you to experience other people's memories, but it's not legal. So the ex-cop, Ray finds his character, Lenny, deals in these, like, experiences. So he gives you a weird headset thing and a disc, and you can live out a bank robbery, or you can have an encounter with two women, or you could even be a woman, as that one guy is. At one point, like, you can live anything that you want in a kind of safe way, but then he gets hold of a disc that has, it's a snuff film, and that leads to the whole conspiracy. And it's, the conspiracy itself is pretty well done. It's very, I thought it was very, like, old school, like, film noir, but with a new technology kind of spin on it.
It kind of feels a little bit like a combination of Blade Runner and Assassin's Creed, and maybe a little bit of Hackers thrown in.
Yeah.
It's a nice mix of things, and very 90s.
More successful than Hackers.
Oh, no, but, like, there's the 90s-ness of Hackers. And there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of, like, essentially raver hitmen, not hitmen, raver henchmen who are kind of lame, but try to be intimidating.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's a weird one. I guess, you know, we should cover our expectations before we launch into a lot of blah, blah, blah. But, Jamie, had you seen this... Presumably you didn't watch this in 1995 when it was made.
No, I had heard of it before because Blade Runner is one of my favourite films, and I was talking about it once with a lecturer in university, and she asked me if I'd ever seen this, and she kind of explained it, and I thought, oh yeah, she said it was often compared to Blade Runner, and I thought, oh yeah, that does sound interesting, and I never watched it. Sure. But recently I was looking through Netflix just to whatever, and it came up, and I thought, oh, I should probably watch that and give it a go. So, I didn't know what to expect, because I think this is the only Catherine Bigelow film I've seen, because shockingly, I haven't seen Point Break.
Oh, that's Point Break is quite good, but very, you know, blockbustery stuff, and then Hurt Locker's quite, you know, authentic, and, you know, it's about war, so it's got that sort of thing going on.
Yeah,
those are the ones I've seen, anyway. Yeah, oh, she's a good director in all, you know, this film I think is quite well directed, but she, you know, she's a good one. Anyone else? Any Bigelow thoughts?
Well, I up until I saw this, I thought she was a little bit miserable, like Chris Nolan, to be honest.
It's all right. It's not, you don't have to be guilty about it.
But it turns out, actually, she does have a sense of humour, and she's just done a lot of dark stuff lately. When I say dark, I actually mean more miserable. This was dark, but still kind of zany is not the right word either.
Yeah.
But you get where I'm going.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, what she do? Zero Dark 30? Where is that the one where she, like, it's about the hunt for Bin Laden or something?
Yeah.
That's a, that's got to be a bleak yet celebratory topic. I didn't fancy that. I was just like, ah, no. It's all right. what about you, Anthony? I mean, have you seen any of her other films?
I have. I've seen The Hurt Locker. And I know of her, like, more recent work, but nothing earlier. What I was, what I attached to, with my expectations, was this, was written by James Cameron.
Mm.
Yeah.
Which, while he's an okay director, when you see his name next to the writing credits, that's a bit of a warning.
The thing with James Cameron is he makes very, like very exciting and spectacular films, but they're always so cheesy. Like, especially, like, yeah, the more he's had to do with the actual creative process and not just directing, the more ham-fisted and cheesy they are.
I was going to mention this later, but it does come in here, where the thing about this that I like is that, like I said, with Catherine Bigelow, I find her a bit serious. And with James Cameron, I find her a bit silly. So that when they did this together, they met in the middle, and that was okay. Yeah.
Was there a co-writer as well?
Yes. Jay Cox.
Yeah.
I thought it was a co-op because it felt like a really correctly and well-written thing that had been double-checked. Because if you'd written this yourself, you definitely would have come up against more mistakes than this film. I mean, this probably does have things wrong with it, but it's quite a well-written plot. I'm sorry, Anthony, I cut you off. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just finishing off my expectations. So I don't really know. It's like I kind of expected to have a tone of the similar things from the 90s, like Hackers or The 13th Floor, something like that. But with James Cameron, there was it might be a bit more Hollywood than those, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
so that's what I was coming in expecting.
Yeah, because James Cameron, he's successful, but not with me. I mean, I don't care for his types of movies. But that's not to judge them too harshly. You know, we're not here to judge his films, apart from we are to judge this one, so I'll take that back. But anyway, I guess my expectations were it would be a little bit like Hackers as well, because I think that's why I compared it similar to Hackers, is because I expected it to be a kind of 90s high-tech sci-fi load of silliness, and actually it's a little bit better. It's definitely better than Hackers, but that's fun because it's kind of terrible.
I think it is one of those 90s high tech like sci-fi movies, but there's a proper plot underneath. Like, you could take this plot, change a couple of things around, and put it anywhere in any type of film.
Yeah, it almost, without the sci-fi element, could be a fairly interesting noir film that wasn't sci-fi. Has that covered everyone, actually? Abby, have I asked you? You spoke, but I don't know if I asked you.
I've sort of covered it. You didn't ask me, but I have said things which allude to what I was expecting.
So anyway, how did everyone get on? Don't all talk at once. Let's ask you, Abby, first.
It was one of those movies where, because it had that certain aesthetic to it and was about a certain topic, I kept sort of waiting for it to go terrible, and it didn't. The whole time I was just going, oh, this is really good, but it's going to go terrible in a minute. Oh, it's the end.
Yeah.
That's good.
I think that ties in with what I felt, is I thought, oh, it's not going to be that good, because my expectations were very high. And then when it didn't let me down, and it actually intrigued me as it went on, I was, like, suspicious all the way through, and then it concluded, and I was like, oh, touche movie. Although, I don't know why it's called Strange Days.
No, I
think there was, in one of the nightclubs, I think they had at some point a song with the lyric Strange Days in it, but that's the only kind of reference I can find.
It's a song by The Doors.
Is that is that relevant? I mean, does it come up?
Is it about this? the song in the movie is a cover of the song by The Doors. That seems to be it. That seems to be the entire...
I mean, what else could you have called it? Like, mind watch or, like, playback? Is that what they call doing the mind thing?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I think I would have called it playback or something, or, like, I don't know. Something to do with the actual technology. How did you get on with it, Anthony?
I'm a bit more mixed about it.
Well, you fell asleep, you said, before the podcast.
I did. It was a very slow film to get started. There was a lot of setup, and it felt like, at the beginning, not a lot was really happening. But the film uses, like, this one trick, which is the kind of...
first-person perspective.
First-person perspective, which they use a couple of times. And that is really immersive with this film. And they start off with that. And
for cracking opener.
Yeah, it is a cracking opener. For the first 5 minutes, you're really hooked because it's really quite exciting. You're really kind of feeling the things that the person would in the movie.
Yeah, the first one is what? You're a bunch of knuckleheads robbing a convenience store or something, or a restaurant.
Yeah, it's a restaurant, yeah.
Yeah.
But after that, then the kind of movie kind of dips for about half an hour until it kind of picks back up with, like, the main thread of the plot. But I think it's a really competently made film, and by the end, I was really intrigued, and I liked it enough.
Though one of my criticisms of this movie would be that it's a bit too long, and that they could have easily lost about half an hour across the movie.
Yeah.
It was 2 hours 25, and even though I wouldn't say any bit of it felt saggy and flabby, it could have done to come in under the 2 hours. Just to be 2 hours long would have been enough, considering, I don't know, what could you have lost? Maybe we didn't find out that the limousine driver had a family she had to save because they were that relevant, and I don't know. I wouldn't like to say what I would take out, but it did seem a bit long.
Well, there's one moment in particular I can think of, and that's where Faith took down her dress to oil herself and then put her dress back on again. That was entirely unnecessary.
It's to get across this idea that these are voyeuristic sputty things, and, you know, to make it more adult. And she did do that twice throughout the film. It did seem like, well, we need excuses for her to moisten her body. Yeah, that would be weird. I mean, you know, let's talk about the actual MacGuffin, not the MacGuffin, really. The sort of the hook of the film is. We're in, you know, there. It was made in 1995. It's set in 1999. And I don't remember at the time what the technology was like. I remember living through it. But I'm pretty sure we didn't have mini discs that could allow us to live other people's memories, like beat for beat, feel for feel. Do you guys remember that? I'm pretty sure that technology didn't happen, did it?
I remember mini discs.
Right, but you didn't have, like, a weird Christmas lights thing that you put on your head.
That's the thing. Maybe we just didn't know. Maybe we're picking up these mini discs and thinking, oh, what could you possibly fit on there? Discard them entirely. It turns out you could have this marvellous experience.
Yeah, and we've disregarded them and chucked them away now, and, like, we missed out on living memories a la, kind of, Assassin's Creed have probably done that idea quite interestingly. You know, like, but... You know, this is just about living regular people's lives, even if they're going to do some burglary or make love to someone or do, you know. It's about, oh, sorry, I've got distracted talking about referencing Assassin's Creed, which is relevant, but not that relevant. So back on point, sorry, guys. So anyway, there's this thing, these little, you have essentially a little box with a blinking light on that records stuff, and you put a little... few wires on your head, and whatever you record, other people can then put the thing on and play it back and relive what you did.
But the interesting thing about that was, for me, is that many other movies have done something similar, and I have thought that it was utterly ludicrous. But in this one, I actually bought in fairly easily.
I think it's because they don't do anything especially over the top with it.
It's not a mainstream device everyone can have. It's on the black market and it's illegal because it was used by the FBI or something to do blah blah blah.
It also doesn't do this like stupid like Inception thing. They don't like dive into people's memories and then get lost in layers or anything like that. It's there, and what it does when they set it up is what it does for the whole film.
Yeah, it's almost as straightforward as. Anyone who uses the device basically video records what they did. Only you're supposed to feel it a bit more because it's nerve endings and brain stuff. I mean, it is silly, but it's a simple concept to grasp. They don't overcomplicate. Yeah. Like, what's the most complicated to get is there's one person recording himself, like, breaking into someone's house and attacking a woman. And while he's, raping her, he puts the device on her so he... She will feel his perspective, and that's kind of sick and twisted, but it's the most complicated it gets,
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite dark, really, in tone. There's a lot of really quite, despicable things that go on. Luckily, the main characters all are repulsed whenever something horrible happens, and they go through it. But it's quite a tonally dark film. What do you guys think of that?
I think that's probably why it didn't do as well as it could. Is that not everyone is going to be able to stomach that, I think.
Yeah.
Because, the topic of rape is dark enough as it is, but to have other people trying to investigate the crimes while reliving it from the perspective of the rapist is something that has to happen to some degree, and it's kind of the point of the mystery, I guess. But it's like properly, wow, that is horrible. Yeah. And then having to share it with someone else. Oh, take a look at this. It's not like just a horrible photo. Please feel this rapist do the thing. Horrible.
Yeah.
So, it is an interesting gadget. I was a little bit critical when I was watching it, thinking, so how come this isn't the best invention ever? This is better than the internet. It's voyeurism in its most purest form. It's you get to do what other people have done and feel it. And it's kind of, this would be, surely Nintendo would get hold of this and, franchise it, or someone would be making a lot of money from this gadget, right?
I think that's probably why it was made illegal. Because it's like, oh, this is too good. We can't let people get hold of this.
Yeah, that's my theory as well. That maybe it was even on the market briefly, and people immediately misused it, and it got banned within a year.
Yeah.
Because it's a bit of a flimsy thing. Like, they've invented something for the FBI to, have, undercover people to film crimes. I think that was the thing, is the police were using it to help film crimes. But that's the same as having, a hidden camera or bike.
Yeah.
I guess it's easier because you just put a wig over it. And it's it just seems... Sorry, before we talk wigs. It just seems like, why did you make an invention that not only copies whatever you see, but you can feel it as well? It's like you have the full experience. It just must have come as part of the design. It's an amazing gadget. It's kind of ridiculous that it's just this rubbish contraband in this universe. Sorry, wigs, let's go.
First of all, there's in the initial scenes when Lenny is setting up one of his, filming one of his Live My Pornography shoots, and he finds that guy in the bar, that guy who already has long, curly black hair.
Yeah.
And then puts the thing on his head and then puts a wig that looks like a black hedgehog over his existing hair.
How he ever expected that guy to be able to pick up a woman after that?
Two women? Wasn't it? Yeah. But and then Tom Sizemore, all the way through the film, I couldn't take my eyes off his terrible hair.
Yeah. I didn't think anything was up with him having long hair.
No.
But it seemed like everyone in this 90s version of 1999 had long hair. The women and the men, all just long haired.
So I kind of thought, okay, fair enough. He's got awful long hair, but so does everyone else. And then at the end when it's ripped off, I know it's supposed to be a shock, but I laughed because I couldn't, it was such a sudden shift of him having terrible hair. And then he was bald and he looked as surprised as I did.
He did.
But he also looked better.
Yeah.
Sorry, Abby.
I was just going to say that I've never been so relieved for someone to be de-wigged in my life as when that happens. Like, oh, he's bald. And he looks all right. Oh, he's dead.
No. What I did like, though, is, and I think there's only two examples I can think of right now, but there was a lot of it in the film because I remember picking up on it as it was going. And I don't know if it's like a James Cameron thing because he wrote it, but there's a lot of nice, like, setup and payoff going on throughout the film. Like, the wig thing, like the Lenny putting that awful wig on the guy in the bar. You think nothing of it. It's just a stupid little joke. And then the payoff is that Tom Sizemore's wearing a wig later. Or then you've got the bit about Tom Sizemore's character being colorblind, and he makes a joke about, it's the only way I could ever stand your awful ties. And there's been jokes about Lenny's ties the whole way.
Because he does wear kind of dog-sick ties and shirts under a leather jacket.
But then it's the tie that kills Tom Sizemore's character, because he's holding on over the balcony. Yeah. And Lenny pulls out the knife out of his back and cuts the tie to drop him, which I thought was great as well.
Tremendous symbolism. You've been stabbed in your back. You've been literally and figuratively stabbed in the back by your best friend.
Yeah.
And then you take the knife out of your back to kill the guy. So it is very poetic.
The whole thing was very well thought through as far as structure.
Yeah.
Like, stuff like that unfolds in the same way as the main plot about, like, who killed Iris. And the subplot about Jericho 1 that becomes the driving force of the main plot, and they weave in and out of each other very well.
I mean, my take on it was, I liked the fact that it was building to some kind of greater conspiracy, and why is there someone trying to plan a riot for the millennium? Is there some kind of massive race war about to break out? And then it goes, no, it's actually a lot more simple, and it's just down to like two cops and me having a motive to do some killing and blah, blah. Not me, but the long-haired guy who is the baddie in the end. That doesn't actually give it away because pretty much, like I said, everyone has long hair. But we will talk spoilers because this is spoiler-filled. What did other people make of the whole overarching story and reveal?
I suppose because I was having a bit of trouble getting into the film, because nothing was really happening. When this actually did start happening is when the film got really good. I think it kind of pays off at the end. Although a lot of the things, I think the clues that were put in there by the director were kind of like obvious as to what was happening.
Well, they also show, like, the guy in the mirror. Like, he's got a ski mask on. But at that point, when you see him look at himself through the memory gadget, you kind of go, well, it's not going to be the main guy that's saying it's going to... It's not the evil guy who's obviously evil. It's never the guy who's obviously evil, is it?
Yeah. It's just, like Jamie was saying with the wig, I thought, Tom Sizemore's wig was really obvious, and I thought that he's obviously going to be part of it somehow. And I was kind of happy when he was, because he didn't really do that much during the rest of the film, and I felt he was kind of just really there.
Yeah, he was like, oh, you're a best friend, but you've betrayed me a little bit by working for a man I've fallen out with. Oh, you've turned up and you're helping now, but don't have that much reason to. You know, and then when he was revealed, it's like, oh, well done, you remember to have one of the main characters you've established be the surprise reveal. That's good. I hate it when they do a reveal at the end of the film. It's like, someone you barely realised was in it.
Although they did do the whole... Oh, it's me now. I'll explain everything.
Yes. It was very good of him to be like, I really just want to brag because I've made all these cool memory videos and it was a very intriguing murder rape thingy, and I'll just tell you why and what the, you know, reveal is with your ex-girlfriend and stuff. So here's me telling you everything. Like you say, that's a cheap way out.
I think what I enjoyed more about this is the characters. While not all of them, per se, are well-rounded characters, they were just interesting to watch.
It was an unexpected performance from Ralph Fiennes, I thought, because the things I've enjoyed him in the most are, like, the Grand Budapest Hotel, which is a big departure from this, and also he's quite good in Bruges, and, you know, he's done other stuff. I think he's in Harry Potter or something, isn't he?
Yes.
He is. He is Voldemort.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I haven't seen that, but I do like him sometimes, but he's often typecast as a sort of generic...
angry bad guy.
I would argue that this is the only thing I've ever seen him in where he's dirty. Yeah. I mean, physically dirty.
Long head, kind of looks like a sort of budget Christopher Eccles Cakes. Actually, Christopher Eccles Cakes is probably the budget him. Which, you know, he does look grubby. He's got his slightly cool but loser uniform of, I wear a shirt and tie, but they're kind of terrible, and I wear a leather jacket instead of a regular suit or something. He's kind of, I'm a relatable, like, protagonist to you grungy 90s people.
Yeah.
I enjoy the characters too. Did you, Abby and Jamie?
I had a bit of a problem with Faith.
So did I.
Yeah. Just...
She didn't... other than being obsessed about by him, there wasn't much point to her.
She was, and she was, I think it was the point. She was, the point that they were trying to make is he is obsessed over this awful woman, and he shouldn't be, because he's got,
a smutty, like, cutting-edge drug business to run.
No, he's got, I can't remember her name, the actual love interest, Mace,
yeah.
Yeah. He's got her, like, there the whole time, and he's
being super
obsessed.
Nice.
Yeah. And, like, really, like, faithful to him and, like, helping him and obviously in love with him. And he's still obsessing over Faith, who's just this awful, just trashy drama queen.
Yeah.
Like, scumbag of a woman who is involved with Philo, who is the best, just utterly unlikable villain.
Yeah.
I can't remember the last time I saw
Philo.
So, that's the sorry, thing. If you want that guy, then you just ask Michael Wincott.
Yeah.
I don't know if he enjoys doing those kind of roles. I don't imagine it's something you can enjoy. But he's so good at them.
Do you know what he reminded me of in this? So the way he looked and his voice, calling back to an earlier spoiler field, he made me think of Mark from Rock and Rule.
Oh, yeah. He's the same kind of, oh, you're horrible. And he's into rock and roll a bit, and he's a power maniac to some extent. Yeah. I mean, he's not as ugly as Mark, but he has got a face to hate. No offense. It's good acting, that's what that is. It's not his bad guy face. but they are a little two-dimensional. I agree that Faith is clearly, like, the wrong person for him to be in love with. And, you know, pretty much all the time, everyone's telling him how not in love with him she is. And it seems all we get of their previous relationship, because luckily he relives it in a sort of bizarre, relive my memories, let's go rollerblading together again in my mind.
No one has ever laughed in that way. Reminiscing about rollerblading.
No one. I fell down.
I'm
re-enjoying this. That's the worst part of his performance, actually, is him reliving his rollerblading with his then-girlfriend, Faith. Yeah, just terrible, that reaction. But I like Ralph Fiennes' character, who was called, the weirdly named Lenny Nero.
Yeah.
I don't know I don't know if that's trying to be cool or what. Just whatever. And Angela Bassett was quite good as the limo driver.
Miss.
I liked how genuinely tough she was.
Although it didn't really explain why she was, but you didn't care because she was just going around kind of like kicking ass all the time.
She was a limo driver in like almost apocalyptic LA. So, of course she has a shotgun in her limo.
That was the thing. You didn't really think about it until they had that flashback. And she was a nurse. I was like, really? A nurse?
she's a leading lady in a James Cameron-written film. Of course she's going to be hard as nails.
But it's an interesting character to have. I mean, you know, why some guy who essentially peddles narcotics in the form of mini discs of memories. Like, it's such a weird one, because all the film they're playing this character as being essentially a drug dealer, but he's more entrepreneurial. He has to kind of set up people to do interesting recordings, whether they rob someone or he has to buy the memories of people who've done robberies off a kind of sleazy guy who looks a bit like Ringo Starr, but more 70s. Like, he has to require these discs, and he has to get people to record new ones, and then he has to schmooze clients who are willing to risk, you know, he's at one point we see him sort of trying to get a lawyer who's interested in trying this thing out to buy some memories and stuff. And you know, it's quite the busy and complicated business.
I like that he has to how do. Consistent that character trait was with him, that he's constantly trying to buy people off.
Yeah, he's always fobbing them off. He's always trying to deal bad Rolexes as collateral.
Yeah.
And what's great about it is, you know, most people would write a film like this and the protagonist would, you know, man up and get things sorted. But pretty much every scene he tries to do something, he gets beaten up by someone, and then the, you know, his limo driving kick-ass lady friend has to come in and save him in some way.
You just reminded me, you mentioned Tick, his friend with the moustache, who gets his brain fried.
Yes.
The 70s looking Ringo Starr. Did anyone recognise who that was?
Who was that?
From a previous film bin.
Oh, ooh. No, but Angela Bassett was in FX, apparently.
Well, this is from one of my previous choices.
Oh, who is he anyway?
Spike from Super Mario Brothers.
Oh, that guy, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
I just remember his hair and his collar and his moustache. I must have just... He was just, you know, generic-y sleazeball who has a van with technology and he knows about this stuff kind of guy, wasn't he? Interesting.
That was another instance of them exactly nailing Grubby. Like,
yeah. Look, wasn't he wearing, like, a tracksuit?
He was,
well?
Yes. Yeah.
It's in a weird leather jacket as well. It's this red number. Yeah. It has a kind of... I guess it relates to something like Blade Runner in that it's set mostly at night. Again, why is it called Strange Days in that case? Should be called Strange Nights or something. But it's got that dark feel all the time. Yeah. And it's got a grubbiness and a kind of... It's not about being ultra-modern with the sci-fi. It's about being, you know, everything, all the technology that's weird and modern is grubby and kind of wrong and old.
Hobbled together, and it what I liked about it was that they didn't try and go for a massively futuristic aesthetic. Like, it's still normal cars and building. Like, it's filmed in it looks like it's filmed in a real place.
Yeah, it's only jumping 4 years into the then future. So
now, because it's almost 2019, that's definitely dated it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Whereas, not that Strange Days isn't dated, because they're throwing around mini discs, so, you know.
Yeah.
But it still looks like it could be happening or have happened. Like, it looks more like alternate reality than, ooh, it's set in the future.
That's what I was going to say, is that the problem with, say, Back to the Future 2 is that that would never happen.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, it's like, oh, that could have happened if.
Yeah.
Just. If something had swung left instead of right, socially.
But it's even, like, I don't know, you've got stuff like Google Glass and what's the thing? Oculus, the PlayStation virtual reality thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, but the thing with virtual reality things of this nature, even then and now, and even in the future when we're trying to develop a more virtual reality platform, you're still going to be wearing giant things on your head, and they're going to be very lame and disappointing. It's not, you know, your brain feeling as if it is doing it all, like this film suggests.
Yeah.
But, you know, anyway, what about the visual style? I thought it was very well directed. Like, the first person stuff was intriguing and well done, but generally it's got a kind of dark... It's not really like Mad Max dystopian. Everything's not falling apart. There's just a sense that tension is building and that people could riot. But there's a lot of lights and smoke being pumped into the streets. Very full, crowded streets all the time. A lot of extras being used in slightly guesswork 90s clothes. Like, maybe we'll wear more belts on clothes and we'll still be into neon.
I do like fashion guessing in movies.
Yeah.
And this was one as well where... They didn't even guess what regular people were dressed like. They just thought, what would the freaks dress like? Let's dress them.
All people who go to raves be wearing. Yeah. It wasn't overly that, but it felt like rave culture, but what if we changed a few things? And everyone was just a bit off. But it was like, okay, so there's lots of smoke used, lots of colour used. There's some quite, you know, good use at the end when it's, because it's kind of the countdown to the end, the millennium. And there's a lot of, not confetti, what's that stuff called? That they dump on you as a celebratory thing because it's colourful and cheap.
Yeah, confetti.
Yeah, confetti.
I thought smaller ones was confetti.
No, it was confetti.
Yeah.
A lot.
Maybe too much, but it was good initially when it was just swirling on the floor at the big final bit, you know,
that,
where...
That final rave with all those people that turns into a riot. And there's that shot where you see it from the streets. That was a real rave. They put it on for free for anyone in the area who wanted to come along. And Skunk Anansie, Aphex Twin, loads of like bands performed for free. And they just let these people come out on this set. And they were like, yeah, go nuts. And
I they just told them a bit of raving. Skunk Anansie.
Yeah. And like, obviously, then, you know, the riot with the police at the end wasn't real. But well, I hope. But the actual rave, that's how they packed that many people in. Because I assumed it was just some fairly decent CGI when there's that aerial shot of the city and all those people in the streets. But no.
And they didn't kind of... Sometimes a film feels a bit, you know, film-like because they haven't got that many extras. And they always had a lot of extras. And when they had a few people just, you know, to contextualize the scene, there'd be people running about and, the odd petrol bomb being thrown. It was a very visually stimulating film all the way through, but it had a slightly dialed-up nature. It felt a little fake at times. Maybe that's a negative of the visual side of things. Very colourful in the smoke plumes and stuff.
I don't know if it was a choice by Catherine Bigelow, but there were times when I felt like it looked a little bit like cheap, and I couldn't figure out exactly what that was like.
Yeah, but still, even though at times it felt cheap, despite, you know, having enough budget to do really interesting panning shots and spinning around shots and things, they did a lot, I thought, director, like visually, to keep us interested as well. But I don't know. Yeah, did anyone else get a sort of cheap feeling, or any other comments on the directing or visual style?
I think that's just something that kind of happened in like the early to mid 90s. Yeah,
that's what I was trying to figure out, was whether it just felt like a mid 90s movie. Like it was interesting, but at the same time it was a little bit Baywatch Nights.
it's trying to be cool and appeal to like Generation X's and, you know, basically 90s teenagers and 20 somethings.
Yeah.
They're trying to be cool because it's a sci-fi and it's crimey.
I would say that's probably not a fault of Catherine Bigelow. That is just the film being kind of dated in the general style of it.
Hmm.
Yeah. Overall, I enjoyed it as a sort of visual anyway. And like these characters that we liked amongst the ones we were like, I thought Ralph Fiennes was an interesting protagonist, and I enjoyed the fact that he got beaten up instead of succeeding. And I did like him having a kick-ass limo driver friend who was a really good, like, a really strong, good female character to have in a film.
Yeah.
Did anyone else enjoy Angela Bassett's role?
Oh, yeah.
She did a really good job, actually, of being both tough and vulnerable at the same time. She seemed like a
human being, like a real character. And she was a good counterpoint to Faith.
Yeah, and also what score I liked is Faith is kind of vacuous. She was a prostitute, and now she's a singer in a band. Whereas, what is Angela Bassett's character name?
Mace.
They all had stupid names, didn't they? Mace or Macy, as I shall baby call her. No, she was, you know, they did enough to say, oh, look, she's got a family and she's, you know, a mother and she's working hard and she's got, you know, she's keeping her friend, like, she kind of is in love with her friend a bit and is looking after him, but it's a kind of tough love because he's a complete idiot in some regards. Yeah. And she felt like there was more to her than just, I am a tough black chick and I will fight sometimes in the movie. Like, she did feel authentic, I guess. And it was, you know, I just thought it was a nice change to have someone. I guess when you've got a female director, you're not going to treat women as objects as much. And that's good. Even though they totally did. Because they was like, should we have some boobs in this clip? Yes, we shall.
I think... don't know, that seems to be one of James Cameron's things, is he likes to put in a strong female character whenever he can. Like, he kind of set the precedent with Sarah Connor.
Let's dance with the poor down in the lower decks. Yay! Yeah. Wow, it's so novel being poor. Please draw me like one of your French girls. Yeah, he loves strong women, doesn't he?
she rebels against Billy Zane in the end. Spits in his face.
How dare she? Yeah, you know. So I enjoyed going on the journey with them. But it is... it's mainly just one guy who is in this memory drug trade thing, finding out that one of his associates, I guess there's a woman, there's a prostitute who's been either friends or working with him, and she's kind of on the run from the cops, as we establish early on. And he's investigating why, finding out that A, she's been killed, and why, and then he's given all these tip-offs in the form of an envelope that says Nero on it, and then essentially a disc to play of a murderer who's filming himself going killing people or raping people or whatever.
I like the scene where he's given one of those clips and he watches it, and it's the murderer coming into his house while he's asleep and putting the little box cutter knife thing up to his neck. Like, that was very effectively creepy, because that is a really unsettling concept.
They did do a bunch of different things with the headsets. To each one in turn made you go, not right.
I feel really dirty now.
That's both dark and creative. Well done. Yeah. You are a creep. And I guess you're building a sense that, okay, we're establishing there's a guy who has access to this technology and is using it. I don't know, he seems to be, because it's his best friend, we know that because it's revealed at the end. But so this guy's motivation is that he's essentially a bit of a creep. He's stolen this guy's girlfriend, and it's quite a complex... He's caught up in the guy's life quite a lot. And meanwhile, he's also going off killing people who could either... who essentially will... Who know stuff that... Yeah. I guess it ties into this murder of a fictional rapper, singer, bloke. What is the deal with the...
He's a rapper, but he's Jericho also won. Like a... Yeah, but he's also like a... He's becoming a political figure, and he's emerged from like the ghetto of LA. So it was deliberately meant to reflect the Rodney King incident from 1994. And the basic like gist of that was the cops pulled over a black guy and like said that he was acting threateningly, and they just beat the hell out of him, and it was caught on tape. And that led to like riots in LA in the early 90s. So this film is like a comment on that. But it's caught on film by Iris, one of the prostitutes. These cops pull Jericho One over, and then when they realize who he is, they kill him. And it's caught on her head recorder thing. So she has this evidence. So now that freaks Philo out, and he like wants to clean up the mess. And he gets Tom Sizemore's character to go around and like take care of Iris, and then set it up so that it looks like it was Lenny the whole time.
Yeah, I see. So everyone's basically trying to cover themselves, getting caught up in murder conspiracies and having this technology they're not. And basically, when you're all committing, you know, crime involving these memory things, you all want to cover your back. And essentially, Lenny can be their Patsy or Rube, who they set up. And
no, I was going to say, you've also got this nice, like, what are we going to do thing with the tape of them killing Jericho One, because Tom Sizemore's character says if they hand over the tape, there's the potential that it could lead to practically civil war.
Because it's the subtext. The background to the narrative is that a lot of people are sick of the world and how it is. There's a sense of racial riots about to happen.
Yeah,
and at the turn of the millennium, there's a kind of idea that there's either a conspiracy in play or that people will just riot and it'll have, like you say, a civil war. And then there's also a sense that the cops might be corrupt. So how much good will it do? And essentially, a lot of characters' families could be killed or involved in the civil war that is set off by putting the truth out there. So it's quite a complex and interesting tale, I suppose.
That's reminded me as well that talking about the characters, I really liked the two cops, William Fichtner and Vincent DeFrofter, or no, who were this nice, like, constant presence throughout the film.
Yeah, they don't necessarily have that much to do, but they really make, like, a big impact.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the strength is in them themselves, the actors. But you never quite know who they're working for or if they're working for anyone.
Yeah, there's a sense that they're either just out for themselves or that they're part of a bigger conspiracy. And we don't know anything about them as characters. They're just a threat that runs throughout. And it does make it quite an adrenaline-filled, you know, film because of their constant appearing and chasing people and stuff.
I like that they have spectacular comeuppance at the end.
Go on.
When they're finally confronted and they get... William Fichtner shoots himself in the mouth rather than being taken alive.
Yeah.
Which splatters all over Vincent's face. And then he pulls a gun on Mace. Lenny takes the bullet and then the other cops gun him down.
Yeah.
And it was such a crescendo of finally these characters, you know, getting in the world of this film, pretty much what they deserve. It was a satisfying, like, little bloodbath.
Yeah, it's quite the image. A crimson-faced police officer handcuffed to another one, dragging him across the floor in the middle of a packed, like, street at the turn of the millennium. Like, this. Whoa, that's quite the showdown, considering.
Because it is quite the image.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're never going to cover every beat for beat of this film. What other elements haven't we talked about that are probably worth mentioning?
The kind of grungy kind of soundtrack that they play throughout the film.
Industrial, driving metal soundtrack.
Yeah, and a little bit of hip-hop as well, because, you know, the 90s was about metal and hip-hop.
Yeah.
it kind of fitted really well with the aesthetic of the whole film.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're often in rock concerts and things because of the setting of a lot of the bad guys are, you know, owners or proprietors or something of... It's somehow connected to the rock world, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's her name? Faith is a singer.
Yeah.
Does she actually, like, because... what's the actress's name? She's actually a singer as well, isn't
Juliet
she?
Juliet Lewis. Yeah, that was her. The songs were written by PJ Harvey. And
of course.
she performed them.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense in terms of casting that, you know, you'd pick her. I mean, she's got an interesting look as well. It's just a shame that her character is a bit...
Yeah, I don't
We
think...
all know that she's flawed and rubbish, you, Ralph Fiennes. Why won't you learn? She only went roller skating with her and stuff. Maybe had a hot tub with her at some point.
I will agree with Anthony that there's... My one major problem I had with this was that there was too much setup at the beginning. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Everyone's pretty much said the same thing. The film is a good, like, half hour too long.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
But I think it sometimes over-clarifies some things. Like, they explained why the bad guy did what he did. They also explained what he did, and they kind of reiterated it. So at no point were you left going, what's going on? But it was, it could have maybe... Let us understand it anyway without telling us again.
It was clarity, but at the expense of pacing.
Perhaps, occasionally.
But I wouldn't say I was ever bored. Like, I was never thinking, oh God, is it going to end? But at times I was thinking, okay, I get it, you can keep going.
Well, we had fights, we had car chases, we had banter, we had kind of people talked themselves out of situations, people ran from situations, we had sci-fi stuff. There was quite a good scene when they were in the limo being chased by these two cops.
Yeah, that was good.
And they're kind of, it's bullet resistant, and haha, it's a nice little joke. And they're being shot at, and they kind of lose a tire and get to the docks or something. And then the cops are like, okay, you're trapped, we're going to burn you in here. And I liked they're like, oh, that's quite good, they're trapped, they're burning in a limo. And then they have to drive off the docks and then escape a car underwater. That's quite a creative little set piece that I quite enjoyed. them dealing with.
And the other thing as well is, I would say there was an abundance of what I would class as special effects in the film for a sci-fi. Like, apart from the like visual distortion on the first-person scenes, there was no, like, that I saw, particular CGI or anything like that. A lot of the, like, chase or action effects were practical. Like, they were all practical. The only, like, effects I can remember were from the memory thing.
Which
is nice. It's a nice change of pace, especially now. Because, you know, every sci-fi that's made now is loaded with CGI, which is fine because it can be used effectively. But it is also exhausting sometimes, and it does make you feel like you're just watching a cartoon.
Yeah, a lot of the fight scenes are quite brutal and they're not like, they're choreographed to be entertaining, but sometimes it felt more of a struggle than a sort of, yeah, I'm a martial arts expert, pow, pow, pow.
The fight between Lenny and Tom Sizemore's character at the end, once the reveal has happened.
Max, is that his name?
Yeah.
We're all over the shop, it's fine, carry on.
But yeah, the fight between them in the hotel room with the mirrors is nice and like desperate and close quarters, and there's no like big punches being thrown or anything. They just kind of struggle all over each other. And they do real things that someone in a desperate situation would do, like when they fall through the table and Lenny gets the gun out of Max's hands by rubbing his hand against the broken glass. The edge of the broken glass. Yeah.
Ooh, nasty.
Yeah, like he's on top of him, and he's just putting his hand in his face because he doesn't know what else to do.
Yeah, it's a very untypical, you know, thriller action thingy as well, because at no point do we like, this guy's our true American hero.
Yeah,
he's not like that. It's much more of a one man's noir struggle.
Yeah, I like the fact that he's always just a bit rubbish all the way through.
Yeah, that's what I said exactly. So. I mean, we're in agreement in that regard. Does anyone else have other bits and points they'd like to bring up that are maybe worth highlighting?
There's one thing I want to bring up that isn't really about the movie exactly. But it's just, I'm really disappointed that I have to add this movie to the dog death count.
Oh, yeah. Like, every film that has a dog in, you can pretty much, 9 times out of 10, that dog will die. Like, so many films kill dogs. I don't even care anymore. Like, I just see a dog, I think, well, that's dead at some point. Like, it's almost films that have nothing to do with dogs will just put a dog in and kill them. And this was one. It adds to the massive list of films that kill dogs.
And it kind of teases you at first as well, because you think, oh no, they're not going to kill the dog. But they do.
Yeah, the baddies do, because they're baddies. Being an enjoyable film, it knows that we're suspending our disbelief because it's a silly premise, and it gives us a nice range of thrills, I thought, and a nice thinking sci-fi as well without overly taxing our mind, you know.
I can definitely see though why it didn't perform at the box office.
Oh yeah, why do you think?
Because
Matrix hadn't happened yet, and
yeah,
we weren't ready.
I do think it would do better now.
It would.
Like, if it would, yeah. Because I don't think people were ready for something in their sci-fi with this much complexity to it in the 90s, in the mid-90s.
Also, the trailer wasn't very good. The poster is a bit, well, we don't know what this is about. It doesn't feel like it could have been marketed very well.
It is dark, too. Like, there are times
when you
feel dirty watching it.
Well, that's partly what it's about, in a way, is the moral and the moral minefield and unethical nature of living other people's memories. And if people do bad things, you basically, by indulging in them, are doing them to yourself.
Yeah.
And yet, that's the breadcrumb trail Lenny has to follow, is he has to do what the murderer does throughout.
Yeah. And I think that's too, maybe not now, but like back then it was too challenging. Like now you've got films like Inception are like huge blockbusters, which wouldn't have happened in the 90s either. I think had that come out then, it would have been a flop because people weren't ready for that kind of thing.
That could be true. So I guess we should move into our final thoughts on Strange Days. Who knows why it was called that? But, you know, I guess we need a rating as well. We're coming out vaguely positive. I think Anthony has been you know, what would you say, Anthony? Did you like it by the end, or do you still have reservations?
I did like it by the end. I just think, you know, it took me a while to get into it totally. Yeah. Which is weird, because, like I said before, the first, like, opening scene is so good, and it hooks you so well, that the rest, the next bit is just a bit limp because of it.
There's a good half an hour at the beginning where it felt like nothing was particularly happening. It was all set up.
Yeah, and, like, I could see what he was doing. I could see it was setting up these characters and what they do and how they act and all that, but...
Yeah, it doesn't do it badly, it just... It needed to be rearranged, or
it needed some more urgency. That's all.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's an interesting character to get used to. I think by the end of the film, Lenny, you like, and you get to understand him, and his character is consistent and interesting.
I think,
but early you're like, what is this?
I think the moment I decided I liked him was when his car was being towed, and he gave the guy his watch. And then he went to, his car got towed anyway, and he opened his suitcase and pulled out another identical watch and put it back on his wrist.
It's a nice gimmick to have.
And that. I thought, I like this guy.
Yeah. You know, what can we rate it as, really? I don't know. Weird headpieces. What piece of silly redundant technology is it now?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean... Okay, Abby, let's start with you. Last thoughts, and if you can think of a rating system, maybe you'll think set a precedent.
I like this movie. I had some problems with it, but overall, I get a green light from me.
And some smoke and, like, dry ice and a kid running across, and then a Molotov is chucked, all that stuff. And some red lights and blue lights. And some lame ravers who want to fight all the time. Sorry, you're saying it gets greenlit, sorry.
I'm trying to think of a headpiece. And I think maybe it's those flexible glow sticks that you can sort of chain together.
Yes.
Worn as headwear. Where it's...
Very 90s as well, that is.
Yeah.
It's very 90s. And if you look at it... I can't put this now. If you were to stand in just an empty living room in daytime wearing a neon thing on your head... You'd look silly. But because it was pitched exactly right, it was dark, it was noirish, then it actually works really, really well.
So you're saying because it's dark and noirish, it kind of shines and is good. And, you know, if you're not into that sort of thing, it's kind of, what is that? That's silly. Don't be a daft person.
Yes.
I like that. That's cleverer than anything I could think of while I'm stewing now. So who wants to go next? Jamie, maybe?
Okay. I liked it, but I'm in Anthony's camp. Like, it took me a little bit too long to get into it initially, because after that, like, incredible opening scene, it seemed to go a little bit flat and just meander a little bit before it really got going again. But once it did start going, I got, like, the longer it went on, the more I got into the plot and the more I wanted to see it come together, and I think it did come together very well at the end. And it has a consistent aesthetic all the way through. Consistency, it defines it, really. It all kind of makes sense. They never, like, step outside their own rules. Nothing happens that makes you go, wait, what? Like,
it sets up a universe, and it gives you a satisfying, clever plot that you go, well done. I'm sure if we pore over it and niggle, we'll find problems, but you by the end, you are satisfied.
I don't know if maybe it was a little bit heavy-handed with the Rodney King reference thing at the end, but I was into it enough that I didn't particularly care if it was. And because I knew it was written by James Cameron, I was expecting a little bit of heavy-handedness anyway.
I mean, it was a different... And also, because it was from 1995, that kind of...
Yeah, that was...
Black Americans were suddenly... You know, there was that tension back then.
Yeah, exactly. And it
coming
it
out
was
through
commenting,
rap music and...
It was commenting on something that was relevant at the time. And something that mainstream science fiction in particular wouldn't have done. So that was quite a... That was a brave thing to do anyway. I thought it was... good, if a little bit over long. I think I was going to go with the obsolete 90s technology racing rather than the headwear. because right. I thought...
We're always doing headway, in fairness.
It reminded me of one of those CD players, one of the first ones that came out with a built-in MP3 player.
All right. I thought you were going to say one of the ones when they weren't shock-resistant and they just cut out all the time. But one with a built-in MP3 player.
Yeah, and you know, and all the elements worked together, but it had bits on it that weren't necessary. Like, you don't need a bass boost. That doesn't really do anything. You don't need a shuffle on a CD player because it's just one album in there. Why do you want to rearrange the order of the tracks?
Right.
And the MP3 player works fine by itself. The CD player works fine by itself. Altogether, it's fine, but there's a little bit too much to like bog you down.
Mm.
And you eventually decide which one you're going to use more, the MP3 player or the CD player.
There's also...
So you need to lose a bit of it, and then it works.
There's also usually a redundant button that you could have looked up in the manual, because you don't have the manual anymore. And it's just some random little button that says something like PNT. Or something like that. It's like, you press it, nothing happens. You press it again, nothing happens.
Okay, I think I understand. Anthony, do you have like a... something rating wise?
I was going along the similar lines as Jamie there, but I couldn't quite think of anything. But it's just something that has it has a lot of things that you don't necessarily use.
Like a radio toaster or something.
Yeah.
I don't know, that was just do they have radio toasters? They must have.
I don't even know if that's a real thing.
But something that kind of thing, like I don't really know what to say. Kind of Jamie kind of summed it up really well there for me. I will add that I think the acting is really good, and you really like all of the characters in this. Well, the ones you're supposed to like, anyway.
And even the sleazy ones feel really enjoyably sleazy.
Yeah,
and bad.
They're fun to hate.
Hmm.
And it's a solid film. Its aesthetic kind of like holds it all together. It certainly looks kind of like expensive in terms of lots of people, lots of lights.
Effort
lots of
has
sets.
Been made.
Yeah.
Money has been spent.
And just competently made, but it just needs a while to get going.
Yeah.
Maybe something like, in terms of technology, something like hair curlers or something.
Right.
You break them out, you're all excited, and then you have
Kind of you don't have hair curlers or curly hair. Why are you excited about hair curling?
Well, I'm guessing whoever's broken them out is excited to curl their hair. I don't
know. Roleplay, Rich. Get behind it.
I'm just curious why someone who's never had long curly hair would suddenly be like, it's like hair curlers.
I just couldn't think of anything else that you'd have to wait to use.
Okay.
Because you have to wait for them to heat up, and then... But then you just have to wait, and then you put them in, and it's like, oh, my hair's all curly. Let's go.
I see. That makes sense. It takes a while to get going, and then once it's going, you get the results you were after.
Yeah.
Right. Leaving me, I haven't got much. I'd say the film generally, especially the first opening bit, reminded me of the video game SWAT 4, where you are a SWAT team, you know, doing what they do, breaking into a location and handcuffing the baddies or taking them down with the nasty bullets and stuff. And the first restaurant thing with the criminals is a lot like the game SWAT 4, only it's from the baddies' robbers' perspective. And in, you know, the game, you're the cops coming in to stop the restaurant that's being held up with guns. So it felt like that, and it's the computer game perspective. And if you like computer games, you know, this is a good film to see, like, how a movie does the similar sort of thing of people essentially escaping into a game, even though in this case they're supposed to be real life. And there's definitely, like, twins with escapism. And SWAT 4 is very dark tonally. There's a lot of, you know, situations that have quite dark moments and scary characters that you either shoot or arrest or, you know, report their weapons or whatever you do. Like, but it's a really good game. I really enjoy it, and now it's dated, just like this is. Like, everything's going to get dated eventually, but it does have, you know, a good... Like, it's a good game, and this is a good film, and it, very tonally similar. If anyone had played SWAT 4, they know what I'm talking about. And I can recommend looking up Let's Plays for SWAT 4, because they are funny. Because it's a very frustrating game for when you get something technically wrong, or you get you know, the multiple things going wrong. It's a very fun Let's Play, I would say. Anyway, enough recommending Swap 4 Let's Plays and finishing the podcast, right, guys?
Indeed.
It is SWAT 4. It is a curler. And it also has MP3s and CD functions. And what was yours, Abby?
Neon headwear.
So it's a neon headwear. It's all those stuff. And kind of, it's its own thing as well. Yeah, I mean, you know, what's left to say? That's it. Well done, team.
Woo! Woo! Yeah. So excited.
Happy New Year! So, we should just say goodbye, right, guys?
Bye!
Bye!
Bye! Bye.